Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Cooper Union, to the Great Hall, and to the next lecture in our series on the United States Constitution. Today's lecture, I should say, is about the perhaps the most controversial amendment to the United States Constitution, the Second Amendment. But in fact, as we've seen in the most recent political campaigns, it's hardly controversial at all. Nevertheless, we're going to hear about it tonight from our speaker, Professor Bert Newborn, who is the Inez Milholland Professor of Law at New York University and founding director of the Brennan Center at NYU Law School. He's also, as you probably have heard me say before, for many years he was the legal director of the ACLU. He was also the lead attorney, the lead counsel in the Holocaust cases that won judgments of, I think it's something like $8 billion of reparations. So we're going to hear tonight about the Second Amendment, and since we are in a college, and as you know, colleges are famous for their adherence to their traditions, I'm going to invite you to join me in a little Cooper tradition. Take one of these, press the off button, and Professor Newborn.
Welcome back. Thank you for coming. I hope that that you and those close to you endured the suffering and dislocation caused by Hurricane Sandy without too much loss and too much discomfort, and that your lives are returning to normal. And I'm grateful that with all the disruption that you found the time to join us tonight. And I'm sure I don't have to say this, but I think it's important to keep saying it. Our hearts go out to the victims whose losses, human and material, are so much more tragic than our own, and we should keep them in our thoughts. The after effects of the hurricane forced the postponement of last week's talk until tonight. And I'm going to try to make up for lost time by condensing the two final lectures, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, Federalism and Separation of Powers, into a single lecture on December 13th. But don't worry, I won't leave anything out. I'll just talk twice as fast. I also feel it's necessary, because I think anybody who speaks in public has to be absolutely honest about things. It's necessary for me to announce a change in my position on campaign finance reform. You remember in the second and third lectures, I said that I thought Citizens United might have been the worst case decided that I can ever remember, and that money was a dreadful thing in the elections, and it was destroying the egalitarian nature of our democracy. I'm now beginning to rethink that position. I now actually am toying with the idea of compulsory spending at the one that everybody in the top 1% of the economic population should have to spend lots of money on the election, because I think in the long run it may be the best redistributionist system that we have in the country. It's better than taxes. When you think of Sheldon Adelson putting $10 million back into the economy, and Linda McMahon putting $100 million back into the economy during those years, maybe I've just been wrong. Who knows? Okay. Tonight we turn to the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. As you know, one of the overriding theses of this lecture series has been that Republican and Democratic justices tend to decide hard constitutional cases in characteristic ways by using characteristic value packages that Republicans or Democrats will have to break ties in close cases. And I've said in the first lecture that there's nothing wrong with that. Indeed, it probably is the only way that they can break a textual tie when there's no real precedent. They have nowhere else to go but their values. And that the Republican justices will tend to use autonomy as their prime value, and the Democratic justices will tend to use some other community value, often equality, sometimes communitarian values, as their prime value. There's no stronger example of that thesis than the way the nine current justices read the Second Amendment. The five Republican justices, as we'll see, read it as an autonomy amendment, guaranteeing individuals the right, as part of their individual autonomy, the right to own and use a gun. Democratic justices view it as a communitarian idea, saying, yes, you can have a gun, but not to use by yourself. It's supposed to be used in connection with an organized force that's designed to protect the community. And they break down 5-4, Republican and Democrat, as long as you accept my thesis that Stevens is an honorary Democrat. They break down 5-4 on that, and there just isn't a stronger example of my general thesis than the Second Amendment. Now, given my disagreement, and I'll make it clear as we go forward, given my disagreement with both the Republican and Democratic readings of the Second Amendment, the title of tonight's lecture should really be The Second Amendment, Its Cause and Cure. But that wouldn't be scholarly, and it wouldn't be fair to James Madison, who awarded the Second Amendment pride of place immediately after the iconic First Amendment, and he did it for a good reason. If, as I argued in Lecture 3, we have to read the Bill of Rights, or we should attempt to read the Bill of Rights as a poem, as an integrated whole, we must respect Madison's placement and his reasons and seek to integrate the Second Amendment into the modern fabric of American life as a vibrant and important aspect of our current freedoms. That's the enigma of the Second Amendment that I'll discuss tonight. Now, public concern over gun-related violence in the United States usually centers on horror stories like the Columbine or the Aurora massacres, or the attempted assassination of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, or the Texas Bell Tower shootings, where psychopaths use easily accessible guns with massive killing power to murder large numbers of innocent bystanders. The NRA would like you all to believe that that's the problem. The NRA would like you to believe that the real problem is that there are a couple of bad apples in the country that get their hands on guns and kill large numbers of people. And if we could only stop the bad apples, then we would cure our gun problem. Now, they don't tell us how to do that, but their rhetorical argument is guns don't kill people, criminals kill people, or psychopaths kill people, or psychotics kill people. Now, since the only way that the psychotics can kill people is to get the gun, the NRA argument is absurd on its face. But the issue is much deeper than that. It's not a problem with just a few psychopaths. Our problem with gun-related violence in this country isn't just about a few psychopaths with lethal weapons. It's far more deeply ingrained in an American society where 34% of all households report ownership of one or more guns. The figure rises to 80% in states like Montana, where the massive tide of legal and unlegal, lawful and unlawful weapons can inundate an entire neighborhood, indeed an entire city. And here's a statistic that absolutely stunned me. The United States has 5% of the world's people and 50% of the world's guns. As a nation, we experience 10.2 deaths from gunshot wounds per year per 100,000 persons, the 11th highest per capita gun fatality rate in the world. Colombia is first. Mexico ranks above us, 9 of the 10 countries that outrank us in per capita violence, gun violence, are Latin American countries like Colombia and Mexico, or Caribbean countries like Jamaica that are deeply mired in the illegal gun trade. Now, translating those abstract statistics into real-world experience, if you lived in an American town with 250,000 people, more than 25 of your neighbors could be expected to die each year from gun-related causes, murder, suicide, or accident. More than half would be 20 years old or younger. And if you lived in Mississippi, the number would rise to 50. In some areas of the country, like Virginia and Washington, D.C., more people die from gunshot wounds each year than from automobile accidents. We also experience more than 200,000 reported non-fatal gun-related injuries each year. 10 years ago, it cost an average of $17,000 an incident to treat each non-fatal gunshot wound. It's probably far higher today. If, as I think it's fair to estimate, the taxpayers will bear at least half of the cost of that kind of medical care, we shell out more than $2 billion a year in order to treat non-fatal gunshot wounds. Now, with those numbers, the fatality numbers and the accident numbers and the cost numbers, if you were to substitute the phrase gun virus for gun, it would trigger a nationwide medical emergency. Institutes would spring up overnight to eradicate the gun virus. Government funds would flood university environments to encourage research on the gun virus. Charities would compete to raise private funds to combat the gun virus. Young people who would be deemed to be most at risk from the gun virus would be shielded in every possible way, with high schools and colleges leading the list of gun virus-free zones. But because gun ownership and use are so deeply ingrained in our national culture, and because the current Republican reading of the Second Amendment guarantees individuals a freestanding right to own guns, when we shift the focus from gun virus to just plain gun, we move from a medical emergency to a constitutional debacle. As it stands now in modern America, non-recreational ownership of guns and non-recreational gun ownership and use are not deemed social pathologies intimately linked to premature death and massive social and economic cost. Instead, owning a non-recreational firearm, and I say non-recreational because I'm trying to distinguish between an ordinary hunting rifle and the kinds of guns that we really are dealing with. Instead, owning a non-recreational firearm is seen by many as the dignitary right of a free person, enabling some kind of heroic armed resistance to state tyranny at some point in the future, if such heroism should ever become necessary. In other words, a teenage boy's dream about what he'll do in the world. Some years ago, I worked on a Supreme Court free speech case called Woolley versus Maynard, defending a New Hampshire resident who went to jail rather than display the mandatory state motto on his automobile license plate of live free or die. After a long legal odyssey and 2 15-day jail sentences, the guy finally won. Supreme Court reasoned correctly that the First Amendment, under the First Amendment, government compelled speech is just as bad, it's probably even worse than government suppressed speech. Now, I wonder, though, given the way we use guns in this country, whether the motto shouldn't have read, live free and die. What can we say about a Republican Constitution that turns non-recreational gun ownership into an act of sublimated revolutionary heroism, but does not protect the right to vote, does not protect the right to fair representation, and does not protect the right of a Native American to use peyote in a religious ceremony? It doesn't have to be this way. In lectures 2 and 3, I argued that recovering the poetry embedded in a close reading of Madison's First Amendment would yield the incalculable treasure of a First Amendment right to vote. Last week, I argued that embracing Madison's understanding of the two sides of divine madness would lead to the adoption of the democratic constitution's intense protection of freedom of and freedom from religion. A similar Madisonian structural reading of the Second Amendment is possible that gives full weight to both the complex text, which we'll discuss in a moment, and to its placement immediately after the iconic First Amendment, while freeing us literally from the dead hand of the Republican reading of the Second Amendment. Now, before exploring the legal debacle that is the Republican Second Amendment and considering possible alternative readings of the text, I think an important policy caveat is in order. Substituting a new reading of the Second Amendment will not solve our gun problem any more than our drug problem has been solved by laws. Much, perhaps most, of the violence associated with guns in our urban areas is caused by illegally possessed weapons used in connection with drug-related violence or some other illegal activity. Outlawing possession of guns, even of certain lethal kinds of guns, entirely would not take the unlawful guns out of circulation. In fact, it might relatively empower precisely those segments of the population who are willing to break the law to obtain and use a gun. And while the empirical data indicates that successful use of a firearm as a means of self-defense against crime is virtually non-existent, indeed, gun possession appears to put the owner at much greater risk, the psychological implications of widespread compulsory disarmament of the civilian population can't be ignored. Whether we should seek to disarm Americans while criminals continue to possess arsenals of unlawful weapons is an important political issue that has to be confronted no matter what the Second Amendment says. But the current reading of the Second Amendment prevents us from doing anything about the problem. Even if we can't solve the problem, the current reading of the Second Amendment freezes our ability to do anything constructive. For example, legislation limiting gun purchase or ownership or importation or manufacture, especially if it were aimed at particularly lethal forms of firearms, like assault rifles, high-powered automatic pistols, would put a dent in the ever-increasing manufacture and importation of massive numbers of particularly lethal guns that fuel the illegal gun trade. And it would lessen the likelihood that psychopaths and adolescents would find an easy road to gun ownership. And finally, it would dramatically reduce the incidence of accidental firearm deaths and put the major mode of impulsive suicide beyond the reach of most persons. So why not just ignore the Second Amendment and authorize urban areas to outlaw or radically limit the ownership of guns and ammunition not traditionally linked to recreational use? Let Montana keep its hunting rifles and shotguns, but let New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, Houston, New Orleans, Philadelphia, and the District of Columbia, our own gulag archipelago of gun violence, attempt to cope with their gun crises free of the Second Amendment. The problem is, of course, that Madison put the Second Amendment there, where it is in the constitutional text for a reason. Its placement immediately after the iconic First Amendment is part of the poetry of the Bill of Rights. Ignoring it is just not an option, unless we are willing to subject the rest of the Bill of Rights to a similar risk of majoritarian veto. Now, as I suggested in Lecture 3, Madison carefully ordered the six textual ideas of the First Amendment, establishment, free exercise, speech, press, assembly, and petition, to recapitulate the life cycle of a democratic idea, with the ideas beginning in the interior conscience of a free citizen and ranging through three concentric circles of increasing public involvement: public articulation through the speech clause, mass dissemination through the press clause, political organization through the assembly clause, and culminating with the petition clause in formal interaction with the state to get the idea adopted. In short, Madison imagined the First Amendment as a living tableau of the tolerant and vibrant democracy he and the founders hoped to bring into existence. And I suggested as well in Lecture 3 that Madison ordered the Second through Eighth Amendments as a precisely organized compendium of the most serious armed threats to the ideal First Amendment on the Hill that he was trying to found. Military overthrow and occupation were seen by Madison as the two most serious perceived armed threats. That's why they are in the Second and Third Amendment. They are the highest ranked armed threats. Madison's concern over abuse of the civilian law enforcement process, which he saw as the next most serious armed threat, are dealt with in the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments, which divide the criminal justice enforcement system into its four chronological phases. The investigation and arrest is dealt by the Fourth Amendment, interrogation and formal accusation by the Fifth, adjudication by the Sixth and Seventh, and punishment by the Eighth. And they provide a structural guarantee in each of the amendments designed to minimize the possibility of abuse. This is not random. You simply don't have a document with the First Amendment ordered as carefully as it is, and the Second through Eighth ordered as carefully as it is, without recognizing that every sentence, every comma, is in a place because it's supposed to be there as part of a larger picture. Madison's great poem, and that's why I keep calling it a poem, Madison's great poem to freedom closes with the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, instructing us how to read the constitutional text. The Ninth Amendment adopts a broad construction of the idea of rights by authorizing the use of analogy and implication to establish new rights that are not explicitly set forth in the text. The Tenth Amendment forbids such an open-ended process when government powers are at issue, requiring explicit textual support for any exercise of power by the federal government. And we'll consider the Ninth and Tenth Amendments and the way they interact with each other in the final lecture on December 13th. Tonight, I want to ask where the Second Amendment fits into this remarkably structured poem. The 27 words that constitute the Second Amendment. Let me read them to you. I wish I could put them up on the screen behind me because the textual argument is complex, but I'll keep trying to come back to it. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This is James Madison speaking directly to you. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, unfortunately, the Second Amendment is currently mired in three unsatisfactory readings by both Republicans and Democrats that mask its true Madisonian structural meaning. One reading, the first meeting, that's called the so-called Federalism reading, treats the Second Amendment as an anachronistic relic of pre-Civil War federalism that's designed to protect autonomous state militias against the regulatory power granted to Congress in Article I, Section 8. As a textual matter, the Federalism reading privileges the first clause of the amendment, talking about a well-regulated militia, and describing, but subordinates the second clause, talking about the right to bear arms. And moreover, the demise of the strong theory of state sovereignty after the Civil War ended support for genuinely autonomous state armies. So in the end, the federalism-driven Second Amendment does little more than provide extremely limited autonomy to a few state national guard units, which in any event remain subject to federalization by the president at his option. In effect, the federalism reading consigns the Second Amendment to historical irrelevance. A second reading, the so-called communitarian reading, is the reading embraced by the four current Democratic justices. The communitarian reading treats the Second Amendment as a means to assure the continued existence of a powerful armed citizens' militia capable of checkmating any effort by a national standing army to stage a military coup. Under the communitarian reading, a well-armed citizenry provides the raw material for an organized citizens' militia capable of deterring a takeover by the nation's military organs. As with the federalism reading, the communitarian reading privileges the first clause about a well-ordered militia, and subordinates the second, talking about the right to keep and bear arms. Gun ownership is simply treated as a means to assure the raw material for people who can serve in the citizens' militia. And whatever the deterrent power of a citizen's militia might have been in the 18th century, when everybody fought with muskets, the type of weaponry that would be needed today to genuinely deter a military takeover would require recognizing a right to assemble a terrifying public, private arsenal. No one seriously suggests a Second Amendment right to own a tactical nuclear weapon, or even a conventional artillery, or machine guns. So the arsenal protected by the Second Amendment could not provide real deterrence to a military takeover. Even more importantly, with the citizens' militia declined and eventually went out of, it became extinct during the 19th century. So the institutional vehicle that was supposed to be the place where the people with guns went to defend the nation against military takeover no longer exists. There is no more citizens' militia. At most, therefore, a communitarian reading is really a symbolic reading about the symbolic right to potential heroic armed martyrdom in a citizens' militia that no longer exists. Now, the democratic justices who adopt a communitarian reading rightly assert, and they're right in saying so, that such a militia-driven Second Amendment no longer has practical meaning in today's world. Thus, as with the Federalism reading, whatever the historical merits of the democratic communitarian reading, it simply erases an important concept of Madison's poem from the modern text. The third reading is the so-called individual rights reading of the Second Amendment. That's the reading embraced by the five current Republican justices. The individual rights reading construes the Second Amendment as a broad guarantee of the right to own firearms. An individual right have nothing to do with membership in an armed force of citizens, and an individual right that survives the historical demise of the well-regulated citizens' militia. A constitutionally protected right to own firearms, argues the individual rights readers, is necessary to reinforce individual autonomy. It's kind of thinking about Immanuel Kant on stilts waving a gun. That autonomy, you have to have that kind of power, or else you're not really autonomous. And that the acts of protecting against military overthrow will take place through individual acts of heroic armed defense or ad hoc communitarian force. Now, as a textual matter, as I think you see, the individual rights reading privileges the second clause about the right to keep and bear arms and completely ignores the first clause, the well-regulated militia preamble. It also fails to explain how an uncontrolled proliferation of privately owned firearms is going to protect, enhance the security of a free state, as opposed to risking armed anarchy and disorder and self-help. Let me read the text again so that you have, now you have the three possible readings, federalism, communitarianism, and libertarianism. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. As a text, I fear that all three readings, all three current readings, they either protect too little or they protect too much. The federalism reading simply erases the Second Amendment from the text. The communitarian reading also leaves the Second Amendment without any real practical effect in the modern world. The individual rights reading does give the Second Amendment effect in the modern world, not enough to deter a military takeover, but more than enough to make life in the ghetto much worse than it has to be. Fortunately, there's a fourth reading, a reading that I call the egalitarian reading, that does justice to both clauses, to the well-regulated militia clause and to the keep and bear arms clause, and gives real meaning to the Second Amendment in today's world and coincides exactly with Madison's purpose in giving the Second Amendment such a prominent place in his poem to Democracy and Freedom. Read as a structural guarantee of the right to keep and bear arms by serving in the nation's formal organs of armed coercion, the army, the police, whatever federal law enforcement agencies there are, the organs of armed coercion that exist today and that have supplanted the 18th century militia. We don't have an 18th century militia anymore. We have an army, we have police forces, and we have federal law enforcement officials. The Second Amendment could recover the vibrancy and the significance of its original role as one of the most important provisions of the Bill of Rights. Thus, when Madison's Second Amendment protects the people's right to keep and bear arms in the context of a well-regulated militia designed to assure the security of a free state, it assures that the organs of armed coercion in the nation remain genuinely representative of the body of citizens they serve. Madison understood that the greatest threat to a democratic polity is the emergence of a powerful military force that is not fully representative of the people it is theoretically designed to serve. He realized that such a non-representative military would not hesitate to turn on a people that it purported to serve because it felt divorced from them. That's why the body of the 1787 Constitution limits military appropriations to 2 years, requires all military appropriations to originate in the House of Representatives, bars active duty military officers from serving in Congress, provides that a civilian elected president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and gives Congress the exclusive power to declare war. Madison, responding to concerns expressed during the ratification process, determined that the protections in the body of the Constitution would not be enough to protect against military overthrow. He responded by drafting an amendment protecting the entire population's right to keep and bear arms as participants in a universal and well-regulated militia. By providing for such a citizens' armed force, Madison hoped to prevent the emergence of the dangerous gulf between the makeup of the state's organs of armed coercion, consisting in those days of a standing army and private police forces, and the general population. In effect, through the Second Amendment, he turned the entire population into the nation's ultimate representative armed force, the citizens' militia. Properly construed, therefore, the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is not the right to own a gun as an autonomous armed island. Nor is it the right to die heroically in a hopelessly outgunned resistance to a military coup firing a single revolver. But it's the right of every citizen to participate equally in the common defense of the community through equal access to service in the nation's institutions of armed coercion. The poetic genius of the Second Amendment is Madison's remarkable insight that the military poses a unique threat to democratic governance whenever a marked imbalance emerges between the makeup of the people and the makeup of the military. The 18th century organs of armed coercion, known to the founders, were profoundly threatening to a fledgling democracy, precisely because they were so profoundly unrepresentative of the body of the people. The 18th century standing armies were often made up of mercenaries with no ties whatever to the polity in which they were deployed. Great Britain fought the Revolutionary War largely using Hessian mercenaries. Even when drawn from the indigenous population, the 18th century military, especially the officer corps, was a caste apart that routinely excluded disfavored segments of the population, especially religious dissenters and the poor, to say nothing of women. Similarly, law enforcement, civilian law enforcement, in the 18th and early 19th centuries was primarily a private responsibility. There were no organized police forces until the middle of the 19th century. And the private responsibility led to self-help by the powerful and the persistence of privately financed, wholly unrepresented armed bands that often acted as nothing other than vigilantes. Finally, the 18th century had a concept of select militias drawn from a narrow slice of the population. Select militias were exactly what the anti-federalists were afraid of, that would be able to overturn the democracy because they were formed by a group of a small group of people representing a small element of the democracy. Now, faced with the threat that such unrepresentative institutions of armed coercion might overthrow the new democracy, Madison turned in the Second Amendment to a well-regulated militia open to all as the ultimate universal democratic deterrent to armed oppression by a military faction representing only a fraction of the nation. Now, to the founders, the very idea of a well-ordered citizens' militia was characterized by its inclusionary nation, the entire citizenry in arms, as opposed to the exclusionary, unrepresentative nature of the ordinary organs of armed coercion, the standing army, the select militia, and the private police forces. Thus, the real antidote to armed subversion provided by the Second Amendment is an assurance that the dangerous gulf between we the people and the members of the organized armed forces of the state would be bridged by a universal citizens' militia capable of defending the democratic whole against an attack by any of its parts. The founders understood that a group systematically excluded from bearing arms will inevitably be treated as second-class citizens and will fall prey to public mistreatment and private terror, both because they have been disarmed and are unable to protect themselves, and because the non-representative organs of armed coercion feel no obligation to protect them because they're deemed outsiders. The 19th and 20th century story of blacks, gays, and women in the United States as political outcasts and victims of private and public violence dramatically illustrates the consequences of being excluded from participation in the organs of armed coercion. Nowhere is the wisdom of Madison's understanding better illustrated than by the tragic relationship between Afro-Americans and armed force. Initially enslaved by armed force, between 1501 and 1850, more than 10 million black slaves were forcibly introduced into the Americas, almost exclusively from Africa. Black Americans were not permitted to serve in the military until 1862. Once the Civil War was won, they were excluded from the officer corps. Even when they served, it was in segregated battalions consigned to second-class status. The United States fought the lunacy of Nazi racism with racially segregated armed forces. Black Americans were also systematically excluded from professional police forces that emerged after the Civil War. At the same time, they were the sustained target of private armed mobs like the Ku Klux Klan. And the history of women and gays excluded from service in the organs of armed coercion and consequently prey to public and private terror parallels the black story. It was not until the desegregation of the armed forces by President Truman in 1947 that racial barriers were removed to equal service in the military by blacks. And after a generation of struggle, gays have finally achieved a formal right to serve in the military, but their right hangs by a thread. Women have finally achieved the right to serve, but still face major restrictions on the nature of the military duties they're allowed to perform. Now, even today, equal access to police forces for blacks, gays, and women remains enormously difficult to achieve, rendering them more vulnerable to private and public terror than their white male neighbors. Madison's brilliant insight that a universal citizens militia was needed to checkmate a non-representative standing army did not survive Napoleon and the American Civil War. The rise of a citizens' army under Napoleon and the tragic perfection of an entire nation in arms during the American Civil War and the invention of universal military conscription in the 19th and 20th centuries eliminated the 18th century specter of an alien and unrepresentative military standing apart from the citizenry. After Napoleon, the so-called standing army was made up of the entire people in arms, a 19th century hyperversion of the old citizens' militia. Similarly, the widespread establishment of professional, democratically controlled police forces in the 19th century lessened the risk from privately armed sectarian enforcers. When the army and the police force are made up of the community and are subject to democratic control and governance, a citizen's militia is no longer needed as a deterrent. The 19th century shift to at least nominally representative democratic institutions of armed coercion drained Madison's idea of a universal armed citizen's militia of its functional importance. In a real sense, the citizen's army and the democratic police force became the universal citizen's militia in random microcosm. Originally conceived as a check on the unrepresentative organs of coercion, the militia's theoretical role atrophied when the very institutions of coercion it was designed to check evolved into a democratically representative citizens' army and a professional, democratically accountable police force. And it left the Second Amendment entangled in its ruins. But despite the demise of the militia concept, the modern Second Amendment retains its importance as one of the most important structural protections in the Bill of Rights. Read structurally, it continues to provide a critical bulwark against the emergence of a dangerous imbalance between armed forces and the people by assuring all citizens an equal right to serve in the armed forces and the police. The surprising, deeply egalitarian structural protection of the Second Amendment is that no group, not blacks, not women, not gays, can be excluded from the right to keep and bear arms as equal participants in our contemporary institutions of armed coercion without risking the emergence of the ominous imbalance between the people and the wielders of organized armed force that the founders identified as the single most serious threat to the First Amendment's ideal commonwealth. Thus, the failure to permit gays to serve in the military and the police violates the Second Amendment. The failure to include qualified women in military combat operations violates the Second Amendment. Indeed, any rule that excludes a qualified segment of the citizenry from service, equal service, in the nation's armed organs of coercion creates exactly the ominous imbalance between force and freedom that Madison's Second Amendment is designed to protect. Unfortunately, not a single one of the current Supreme Court justices appears to recognize Madison's structural plan. In Heller versus District of Columbia, the most recent important decision on this issue, a 5-justice Republican majority invalidated a flat ban on the possession of handguns in the District of Columbia, reading the Second Amendment as creating a freestanding individual right to possess weapons, using the individual rights reading of the Second Amendment. The 4 Democratic justices dissented, reading the Second Amendment as an anachronistic protection of a long-abandoned 18th century citizens' militia. None of the justices espoused an egalitarian reading. While all 9 justices in Heller relied heavily on history in an effort to discover the original intent of the founders, Heller is a nightmare for originalists. For the reasons I canvassed in Lecture 1, massive historical research by both sides produced what it usually produces in these cases, a tie, which was necessarily broken by the justices' values. Now, you have to ask yourself, if originalism can't deliver a consensus answer in a case like Heller, it's fair to ask what value it has in trying to read the Constitution. I mean, the very idea of using an 18th century mindset to set the legal parameters for gun ownership in the 21st century borders on the absurd. I mean, the only reason that we would ever consider locking our legal approach to guns in a modern world of massive firepower in an urban center and lock that into a vision of agrarian farmers and muskets is the promise by originalists that they would give us a clear legal command that would satisfy what we talked about in the first lecture as John Marshall's syllogism machine. In Lecture 1, I scoffed at the idea that historical research in hard cases could uncover single right answers to the meaning of constitutional text. And Heller proves my point. In the end, the nine justices bitterly disagreed over the historical record and held no choice but to use their values to break the textual and historical ties. Justice Scalia, writing for the majority, argued that when in doubt, the court should adopt the reading most protective of individual autonomy, an approach fully consistent with a Republican value package that privileges autonomy as a prime value. Justice Stevens, who I've dubbed an honorary Democrat, writing for the four dissenters, argued that when in doubt, the court should defer to the political majority's reading of the ambiguous constitutional text, especially in settings where the security of the community is involved, an approach fully consistent with the Democratic value package that is more willing to subordinate pure autonomy to democratically imposed restrictions in aid of deeply felt community values. Now, both tiebreakers and Heller are defensible. Whether you agree with one or the other depends upon how you balance autonomy and community need. But neither reading does justice to Madison's poetry. The Second Amendment contains the only preamble in the Bill of Rights, the clause explaining the importance of a well-ordered militia to the security of a free state, followed by a substantive clause protecting the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Imagine for a moment what the First Amendment would look like if it also had a preamble that read, freedom of conscience and the free exchange of ideas being necessary to the proper functioning of Republican government, and then went on with the text. The thrust of my lecture three was that we should read the First Amendment that way, as though it contained an implicit preamble based upon the order of the text. The Democratic justices tend to read it that way. Republican justices tend to read each clause in the First Amendment as if it were torn, isolated from the text. A Madisonian reading of the Second Amendment that seeks to give equal weight to both clauses reveals a very different reading than the amendment that comes out of Heller. It reveals a deeply egalitarian Second Amendment that is neither a bad movie about heroic gun owners defending themselves with small arms fire against the armed might of the state, or an anachronistic vision of a wholly meaningless Second Amendment bypassed by time. A structural reading would recognize that the deep purpose of the Second Amendment was to ensure that the entire body of the people, Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, and atheists, men, women, gays, and straights, retains the right to keep and bear arms as part of the modern versions of the citizen's militia, the citizen's army, and the community's police force, recapturing the crucial egalitarian role of the founders is envisioned for the Second Amendment as a prophylactic against the development of a dangerous disconnect between the organs of armed coercion and the people, especially disfavored segments of the people, is one of the greatest benefits of reading the Bill of Rights poetically. It may be too late. The train may have already left the station. Because remember, when we were talking in lecture one, I talked to you about the consensus constitution that emerges when precedents are clear, and then we have to go on and do something else. We can't keep re-arguing the same issues over and over again. Well, the precedents are now clear. I think the Supreme Court made a terrible mistake, but the mistake is now embedded in the law. And one of the real issues that we're going to have to cope with is whether it's too late to try to persuade them to back up and recognize the Madisonian poetry that they overlooked when they first read the amendment as they did in Heller. If that fails, and I think it probably will fail, because I think stare decisis is important, just like I stand up there and beg them not to overturn Roe v. Wade because it's a precedent and you can't overturn a precedent, someone is going to stand up there and beg them not to overturn Heller because it's a precedent and you can't overturn a precedent. And we can't pick and choose when we use stare decisis and when we don't. So as a principled matter, it may be too late to impose a Madisonian reading, but it's not too late to do something important because Heller leaves open a crucial question. Heller leaves open the question of what the standard of review is going to be in Second Amendment cases. There were three possibles, but two generally used standards of review. As we saw in the third lecture, in the third lecture with the First Amendment, the standard of review we used in First Amendment cases is called strict scrutiny. It says, we trust individuals, we don't trust the government. So if you're going to regulate speech, you better show us that you have some enormously important reason for doing it and that there's no other reason to do it. And if you can't prove that to us, we're not going to let you regulate speech. If they adopt that standard, a strict standard of review in Second Amendment cases, it will become impossible to regulate firearms, just as it is impossible to regulate speech. We want it to be impossible to regulate speech, but it will become impossible to regulate firearms. The alternative standard is the standard they use in economic regulation cases, which is to say, look, as long as you have a rational reason for doing what you're doing, it's okay, go ahead and regulate the market using rational basis scrutiny. As long as the legislature had a rational reason for acting, we'll uphold that. And that's because in market regulation cases, they trust the regulators, but they don't trust the market participants. So they've inverted the conceptions. Remember in the last lecture, I called it the reciprocal assumptions. That operate between the relationship between the individual and the government. Unless they adopt something like a reciprocal assumption that says, we trust regulators, but we don't trust people with guns. Unless they do something like that, we're going to be saddled with a strict scrutiny standard that makes regulation impossible. My prediction is that they're not going to do that. My prediction is that they will allow us to continue to regulate guns under some standard that may be slightly higher than rational basis, but it will be considerably under strict scrutiny. It'll be an intermediate standard that we still have to sketch out. But that's the trench warfare battle that lawyers are going to have to fight in the next 4 or 5 years about what the review will be. And my plan, my hope, is to continue fighting to get them to recognize Madisonian poetry. But if I can't turn them into poets, at least I don't want to turn them into angels of death. Thank you. Thank you very much. As is our tradition, those of you who are hungry should have absolutely no reason to stay. But anybody who wants to ask a question or to make a comment, the mics are live, and I'm delighted to try to respond to any of your questions. Yeah, go ahead.
If the individual autonomy standard is read on anything other than a strict construction, if I follow you correctly, why couldn't I buy a machine gun or even a tank?
Well, there are, terrifyingly enough, if you go on the web, you'll find guys who are making that argument and who take it all the way to tactical nuclear weapons. They want their own Air Force, they want their own bazookas. Here's the way the Supreme Court gets around it. It's an intellectually dishonest way, but here's the way the Supreme Court gets around it. The Supreme Court justices say, oh, I just realized there's this preamble, and it says well-ordered militia. So it's only the kinds of weapons that the militia used to use that are protected. You're laughing. That's what they do. I have to do this every day. I have to stand up there and not laugh. So that's not fair. You can't laugh if I can't laugh. But that's what they do. That's exactly what they do. They link the kind of weapon that is protected by the individual rights reading to the kind of weapon that would have been protected in 1789, and they say, what's the analogous weapon today? It's a handgun and it's a rifle. That's what the fight about assault weapons is all about. They're trying to ban assault weapons. And the gun kooks are arguing it violates my right to, I mean, you don't want to go hunting with an assault weapon. I mean, you can't bring any meat home. All you have is a riddled carcass full of lead. So it can't be used for hunting. What is it used for? And so the efforts to ban assault rifles will be the issue that will force them to decide that case. Someone will pass a statute banning an assault rifle. And that will then go up. And my prediction is they're going to say, We just looked at some pictures and we can't find any militia people carrying assault rifles, so I guess they're not protected. So if there are any such pictures, suppress them.
Hi, I wonder why it's assumed that it's a virtue for the Second Amendment to be poetic. Why not just be clear?
When
the Madison's writing in a fashion that's poetic, you know, it is a beautiful, it flows beautifully, has a certain meter to it. I'm wondering why that's a virtue. If there's two different clauses, why not just spell out the relationship between the two? Because if you, I had the amendment, if you put the words, if you substitute other words, it starts looking like a conditional. Hungry, the pain that I felt in my stomach, I had to have an apple from the fridge. It's not clear whether I would get that apple if I didn't have a pain in my stomach. Why not just spell out the relationship between the two clauses? It doesn't seem like it's a virtue to have it be poetic.
It's a virtue to be poetic because you're writing a constitution for the ages, and you're not writing a shopping list to go to the to go to the grocery and list things in the grocery. Things are going to come up. The reason the Constitution has lasted 200 years, it's the oldest living document that is a charter of freedom in the world. The reason it's lasted that long is that it gives us play in the joints to construe it. And the question is, how do we best construe it? And my argument is reading it as a poem is the best way to construe it. Reading it as a coherent whole and attempting to give coherence to every part of the document.
That's part of the construction. Canons of construction to assume that every part has...
But you can't escape construction. How do you escape?
No, I'm agreeing. But I'm wondering why it's helpful to have a preamble where it's not clear whether it's a conditional or not.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not suggesting that I wish you'd written it a little differently. If we didn't have the problem of how the preamble fits with the second sentence,
right,
then we wouldn't have an argument about how to construe it.
And that's why I think it's poorly construed. That it could have been avoided, right? He could have spelled out the relationship between the two.
Oh, sure. I mean, hey, we could have also avoided rich people spending vast amounts of money in elections.
Oh, yeah.
If only they'd put a little clause at the end saying, but we don't mean that rich corporations can spend vast amounts of money.
Well,
you can't think of everything. That's
an issue of specificity. I'm just saying that it's just the construction of the sentence. Using a preamble, while it's beautiful, it's a disservice in some ways, I think.
The moment I get him on the phone, I'm serious. He made a mistake. It's a mistake. It's a mistake in drafting. But what are we supposed to do with it? I mean, we have to live with the text that we have. Now, you can erase the preamble, which is what Scalia does, and says, it's just a preamble. I don't care. Or you can try to do justice to the entire text.
Right. But I just think that if it's conceded that it's a mistake in the way it was drafted, then the word poetry isn't necessarily a word of praise. Right? In being poetic, there are some casualties to it. Casualties in clarity or in coherence.
All right, well, I mean, I suppose you can say that...
Because we've been using the...
You can say it's a flaw in the Bill of Rights that it has to be read poetically. It would be so much better if they had imagined everything and given us a specific answer. But they can't. And therefore, the question is, what's the next best?
It's not the issue of specificity. It's the lack of spelling out the way that the one clause just... In the use of a preamble, it's not clear whether it's a conditional or not, right?
Sure.
That could have been avoided without having to say, you know, if there's an AK-47 out in 19...
If I were there and I had your wisdom, I would have told them not to use a preamble. But what are we... What do you argue that we should do?
Other than
giving them bad marks for draftsmanship, we have to live with the preamble and do something to it.
Yeah.
Or can I ask you...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, yeah, sorry.
Of course. Is there any?
I don't know whether I've introduced Richard Emery to you. Richard and I have worked on civil liberties cases since just after the Civil War, isn't it, Richard? Yeah. So we've worked together a long time. He was the legislative director of the New York Civil Liberties Union when I was a staff lawyer in the 60s.
So, Bert, has anybody made this argument of the egalitarian interpretation? That's the first question. And then the second question is, historically, What do the Federalists say? What does the contemporary literature say about the Second Amendment? And does it fit with any kind of egalitarian view?
The easy answer to the first question is, I made this argument in an obscure 2007 Law Review article in the Vanderbilt Law Review that was published to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. My mother read it, a few close friends read it, but the press clause has not helped it get mass dissemination. So it's not an, it's an argument that, I have to tell you, when I make the argument, the last time I made this argument was before the Federalist Society, which is the very conservative group of lawyers that over the years has come to dominate Supreme Court arguments. These are very conservative people who buy into Scalia's textual stuff. And I said to him, look, I'm gonna double down on your text. I'm going to take the text really seriously, and I'm not going to let you tear little words out, look at it and read the words as though they're isolated things. I'm going to make you look at the whole text. And they loved it. They loved it, until I told them it meant they couldn't have guns. At which point they shot me and I left. Yeah, the history. Oh, I'm sorry. The second one. The history. History is quite clear. History is quite clear that they saw it as a defense. I didn't read it to you because I hate to read long quotes to an audience. But Madison, in one of his Federalist Papers, says the whole purpose. We have to avoid a standing army. When there's a standing army, it's a threat to military overthrow, and we need to have the citizens' militia as the antidote to the standing army. What he didn't foresee is Napoleon. He didn't foresee the growth of the idea of a whole nation in arms, which changed everything. But it, for his time, it's clear it's supposed to be an antidote to overthrow by the military.